Southwest Universe Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korea says its successful test of an intercontinental ballistic missile Tuesday proves it can carry a large nuclear warhead. The U.S. Defense Department confirmed Pyongyang test launched an ICBM. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said it represents a new escalation of threat to the U.S. and called for global action to halt it. The Hwasong-14 flew less than 40 minutes, gaining an altitude of more than 2,800 kilometers and a distance of more than 900. RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Bennett said it would appear Pyongyang is getting outside help, which may explain its rapid leap in missile capability.
We usually assume that North Korea is doing this all by themselves, that they're not getting any foreign help. And yet I think there's every reason to believe that they probably have some scientists from perhaps Russia, perhaps China, who have worked on developing this kind of missile and are providing information on what a warhead looks like and how it gets through the atmosphere.
The UN Security Council, which has approved resolutions prohibiting the North's missile and nuclear programs and imposed sanctions, will hold an emergency meeting later Wednesday on the latest missile test. Meanwhile, U.S. and South Korean soldiers Tuesday fired what are called deep strike precision missiles into South Korean territorial waters as a show of force. Girls from Gambia and Afghanistan have been denied U.S. visas to attend a robotics competition. The seven girls, two from Afghanistan, five from the Gambia, were to have taken part in the first global challenge involving 160 countries, showing off engineering skills. There's been no official explanation. The two countries are not part of a temporary travel ban imposed on six mostly Muslim countries designed to improve screening procedures. This is VOA News. Qatar's foreign minister has dismissed a list of demands by four countries demanding it cease supporting terrorism. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said the demands by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt amount to Qatar giving up its sovereignty.
There are lots of items which any country can find it offensive within the international law and international norms. The state of Qatar has adopted a very constructive attitude since the beginning of this crisis. We are trying to act mature and responsible manner rather than doing any irresponsible acts as the act of the aggressors which launched an aggression against my country.
Qatar has denied supporting terrorism, calling the charge baseless. In Syria, U.S.-backed rebel forces penetrated the heavily fortified center of Raqqa, the city that has been known as the de facto capital of Islamic State. The development comes as Iraqi commanders prepare to declare victory in their eight-month campaign to retake the Iraqi city of Mosul from its IS defenders. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi Tuesday congratulated what he called the courageous fighters for achieving the big victory and bringing down the false state of Daesh, another name for Islamic State, but fighting there continues. U.S. Senator John McCain visiting Kabul said the U.S. needs a new strategy to win the 16-year conflict in Afghanistan.
And that means to win. The strategy before was, quote, don't lose. And we lost some brave young Americans and a lot of brave young Afghans and a lot of brave children of our allies while we were in a, quote, don't lose strategy. We need to have a strategy to win. The strongest nation on earth should be able to win this conflict.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is expected to present President Donald Trump's strategic options on the way forward in Afghanistan later this month. A draft bill proposed by Spanish secessionists indicates a declaration of independence by Catalonia would follow approval by voters of an October referendum. The Northeast Territory held a non-binding election in 2014, with more than 80% voting to break with Madrid. Spain's constitutional court and national government oppose secession. Philippine soldiers have found the beheaded bodies of two Vietnamese sailors abducted a year ago by Abu Sayyaf militants. They were among six sailors taken captive near Basilan Island when the Islamist insurgents attacked their boat in June of last year. China has invited outside medical experts from Germany and the U.S. to help treat prominent Nobel laureate and dissident Liu Xiaobo, currently at a northern hospital, said to be suffering from advanced liver cancer. The 61-year-old Liu is in the midst of an 11-year prison sentence for subversion. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union chairperson calls on leaders to show political will to end conflicts on the continent by 2020. The UNHCR has temporarily relocated its staff in the Central African Republic.
This is obviously something that would need investigating, but clearly in the context of the CAR, that might be a tall order, given the situation inside the country, where our staff faces constant insecurity threats.
Andre Maheche, a spokesman for the UNHCR. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe donates $1 million to the African Union, but the move is drawing criticism from home. Zambia's government suspects arson after fire gutted the country's biggest market. And Nigeria's military says 700 Boko Haram militants surrender.
Because of a series of bombardment on suspected Boko Haram terrorist hideouts, particularly on the area of responsibility of 26th Task Force Brigade, quite a number of them decided to throw in the towel and surrender.
Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Usman is the Nigerian Army spokesman. Somalia's prime minister says lack of resources is his government's main challenge. And Malawi faces resistance to new bus safety measures after a series of fatal road accidents. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The 29th African Union Summit ended Tuesday in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. The summit focused on three topics, including institutional reform of the continental body, investment in the youth, and unemployment. But, as usual, violent conflicts on the continent and how to resolve them dominated. AU Commission Chairperson Musa Faki Mahamat repeated his goal to silence guns on the continent by 2020. But he said the goal cannot be achieved if African leaders do not put their decisions into action. Mahamat called on the leaders to give priority to conflict anticipation and prevention because he said Africa's economic development depends on finding lasting peace. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe donated $1 million to the African Union to push home the idea of self-sufficiency. Mr. Mugabe pledged 300 cows from his personal herd to the African Union last year. The cattle, along with hundreds more donated from his supporters, were auctioned off in May this year, with the proceeds presented to the African Union on Monday. But the measure has not gone well with some Zimbabweans. Masimba Kuchera, a Zimbabwean economist, tells viewers Praxidis Jeremiah that it is absurd for the president to make such a donation, especially at a time when the Zimbabwe economy cannot sustain such a gift.
The economic situation in Zimbabwe right now necessarily does not allow for such extravagance. You remember that we had pledged a cattle, but it was going to be probably more expensive to ship the cattle from Harare to Addis Ababa. It was also not going to be very useful for the African Union because they probably do not have infrastructure to look after the cattle anyway.
They would argue that this is an obligation to international bodies or regional bodies that he had to fulfill this promise.
It didn't start as an obligation. He's the one who pledged to do this. So it's not like he was forced or he had a gun held to his head to say that he needs to pledge $1 million or to give $1 million. He's the one who made the pledge when he was chairperson of African Union.
ZANU-PF is also making an argument that this is a present or a gift from the first family, and $1 million really is not much.
Yeah, look, $1 million, it may not be much. It's correct. And the source of the resources could be ZANU-PF supporters. But I'm sure a lot of ZANU-PF supporters who are struggling, who could have done with that or part thereof of that money. So there is a disconnect between the leadership and the membership, and there is a disconnect between the leadership and the grassroots. If you tell my Mbuya, who is in Chirimuhanzu or Chendambuya or Jocholo, who is a ZANU-PF supporter, that $1 million is not much when they walk 20 kilometers to go to a clinic, when they are faced with the prospect of hunger.
When he donated and when he delivered his speech, he had a standing ovation. Why do you think he is so popular in Africa than in Zimbabwe itself?
There's no denying that he's still a good orator. He still has a good rhetoric. He attacks the West. He attacks colonialists, things that some of these countries cannot do because they depend on those colonial dollars. But at the end of the day, I think that you see, people in Zimbabwe don't eat speeches. They want to see real development, real change. It is no use giving us historical lectures from time to time. But when it comes to the bread and butter issues of the nation, where the hospitals do not have drugs, where the roads are potholed, if not drumholed, where the infrastructure is decaying and dilapidating at a very serious rate, then there's a serious disconnect between what he says and what exactly happens on the ground.
That was Masimba Kuchera, a Zimbabwean economist, speaking to viewers Praxedes Jeremiah. The UN Refugee Agency has temporarily relocated its staff after armed men in the Central African Republic attacked and robbed the UNHCR premises in the northern town of Kagabandoro. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency condemns the attack against its staff, which occurred late Saturday afternoon. It reports armed men looted all the goods and money on site, including personal items and passports. The UNHCR says the six UN workers were threatened at gunpoint, but fortunately none were hurt. The agency says they have been temporarily located to the UN mission base in Kagabandoro for their safety. It says some will be moved to the capital, Bangui. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic tells VOA the agency has no information regarding the identity of the perpetrators.
This is obviously something that would need investigating, but clearly in the context of the CAR, that might be a tall order given the situation inside the country, where our staff faces constant insecurity threats, but our staff there works in precarious conditions.
The UNHCR provides protection and assistance to more than 8,600 refugees and more than 500,000 internally displaced people. Mahecic says the UNHCR will do what it can to help these people during this uncertain time.
We would obviously consider the return of the staff at the time where it's considered for them to be safe. And obviously the aid that has been on the ground has been delivered, but also we would be making contingency plans in such situations for assistance to the displaced.
Last week, the UNHCR warned renewed violence in CAR was threatening thousands of civilian lives and forcing many to flee. The agency reports more than 5 years of civil war has caused nearly 1 million people to become internally displaced or refugees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, July 5th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Somalia's Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre says lack of resources is the main challenge facing his government as he struggles to deliver services to the public. In this exclusive interview with VOA Somali Service just 4 months into his administration's four-year term, Khayre says although security is the number one priority, lack of resources has been the biggest issue facing Somalia. The prime minister, who attended the just-concluded African Union Summit in Addis Ababa, says he held discussions with his Ethiopian counterpart, Haile Mariam Desalegn, who he says agreed to transfer 120 Somali prisoners in Ethiopian jails to the Somali government.
We've had a lengthy discussion with our counterpart, the Ethiopian government. The relationship between the two countries has improved. It seems to be improving stronger and bolder. There are areas of cooperation that we've discussed on security, on economic growth, on infrastructure, on foreign policy, on other areas that will increase market for Somalia, especially on trade. But prisoners were also part of what we've discussed, and we've agreed that Ethiopia to transfer 120 Somali prisoners that was kept in Ethiopia. We are still concluding the paperwork. It hasn't concluded yet. But we are at the final stages, and we hope that these prisoners will be in Somalia very soon in the coming days or weeks.
And what did the Ethiopian authorities tell you about the reasons they were held or detained in the first place?
These are many prisoners, and they vary from different crimes and different areas. The bottom line here is that our relationship is such that we've reached a stage where we can start to discuss prisoners' exchange, and we can discuss releasing prisoners and work on security along our borders together in other areas.
There are a number of other Somali prisoners who are being held around the world, including India, including other Indian Ocean countries. Some of them are being held for virus-related crimes. What is your government going to do with regard to other Somalis who are being held as well?
We are working on it. On the case of India, for example, we are following. Our justice minister has been working on it tirelessly. We have hired a lawyer. We need to undertake some steps, and we hope ultimately they will be transferred back to Somalia. There are those in Mauritius, in Seychelles, which have had lengthy discussions also with their leaders. We have also taken these steps. We know that due to Maniye's civil war, there are a lot of Somalis who are imprisoned in different areas of the world. The government is working very hard to bring every Somali back home.
Coming back to the issues back home, what were the main challenges that your government faced since you came into office?
Well, for us, security has always been number one priority. Without security, you cannot create jobs, you cannot grow the economy, you cannot build the moral of the people, you cannot develop a nation. But lack of resources is the biggest issue that Somalia faces. Lack of resources in providing services to its people. A government legitimacy is to provide services to its people. And to provide services, you need resources. And Somalia don't have these resources as of today. We are, however, trying to increase our resources, to increase our revenue, to generate as much resources as possible. The foundation of our government is good. The hope of the nation is solid. The motivation of our youth and women and religious leaders, business community, are all positive. With all these indications, I think there is hope for our nation.
Hassan Ali Khairy, Somalia's prime minister. He was speaking with reporter Harun Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. A spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu says arson is suspected after fire gutted the country's busiest and biggest market in the capital, Lusaka, early Tuesday morning. President Edgar Lungu, during a visit to the scene of the fire, called for calm and blamed what he called economic saboteurs for the fires. He promised swift investigation. The country's main opposition, United Party for National Development, the UPND, also called for calm and warned of politicizing the tragedy. Presidential spokesman Amos Chanda says an opposition UPND social media campaigner named Larry Mwitwa has welcomed the fire and called for more such fires. But Mwitwa has denied the government claim, saying it is part of an attempt by the government to avoid responsibility. Spokesman Chanda says the government has begun extradition proceedings for Mwitwa, who is based in London.
It's much more than a market. It's a center for socio-economic activities for Zambians from all walks of life, the poor people, the lower middle class and the poor. So what happened was extremely unfortunate. Police suspect foul play, and they are pursuing the suspect, and we are leaving it at that. But shockingly, social media campaigners for the opposition, UPND, United Party for National Development, the main opposition, they've gone out to social media to welcome that act and calling for more fires set to public property. That is regrettable. One of them is a London-based campaign coordinator for the opposition in the last election, Mr. Larry Mwitwa. The Zambian government has begun proceedings for extradition so that he could come and answer charges for incitement and various offenses. The president has visited the market, has told Zambians to remain calm, asked the security services to move fast and decisively and bring the culprits to book.
You mentioned also about opposition UPND members on social media welcoming the fire and calling for more fires. I have a statement put out by the UPND chairperson, Nulumango Mutale. The UPND, it says, regrets inferno at city market and calls for thorough police investigation.
Yes, we know that Larry Mwitwa is closer to the opposition leader than Mrs. Nalubango is. He read the campaign. He has issued many statements before. And what he says is followed more than what Mrs. Nalubango is saying. So if that is the case, as we know it, then we are worried that the statement might carry more weight. He carried out an online campaign last year that if you destroy a poster for President Lungu, I'll send you money. And he used to send money by Western Union. For every poster destroyed, he would send £50. The statements that he made, the top leadership of the UPND, who are more senior than Mrs. Nalubango, endorsed that. So we hope that what Mrs. Nalubango is saying is well meant. We doubt it so much.
You said the fires happened in the early morning hours. Are there people usually in the marketplace at this time? Because we understand that also this place has a police post and a day and night guards. Is it possible that nobody saw, if it's foul play, that nobody saw anybody doing something?
What happened was the whole place was secure. It was inspected when it was opened around 04 for the sweepers and the cleaners to do their job. Police opened it in the presence of council, city council officials who oversee it. When they just left, that's when the fire started. So the security services suspect that the foul play would have occurred between 4 and 5.
In the meantime, Amos, this is lots of goods that have been destroyed. What is the temporary plan now for the government in terms of what to do about the marketers?
The president has directed that the Disaster Management and Mitigation Unit will rapidly move in and provide some relief to the marketers, and the government will pass an emergency budget, I suspect, very quickly to restore the market so that the poor people's lives have been disturbed could quickly return to business and normal lives.
Amos Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Authorities in Malawi have faced resistance from bus operators as they try to implement enhanced traffic safety measures amid a rise in fatal accidents this year. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Two police stations were torched June 23rd in Malawi's capital, Blantyre, as minibus drivers and conductors protested the new traffic safety measures. Police used tear gas to disperse demonstrations. Officials say the new measures are a response to a rise in deadly road accidents, many of them involving buses. The most recent one killed 10 people in June, when a bus they were traveling in flipped 3 times in Nshewu district of central Malawi. Police spokesperson James Kadadzela told VOA there have been 927 road deaths this year in Malawi compared to 806 during the same period last year.
We are talking of overspeeding as being the main cause. The drink and drive is also following as another factor. We have inconsiderate overtaking or dangerous overtaking.
The government is now requiring passenger buses to install a speed limiter. Under the new bylaws, drivers and conductors of buses that are overcrowded, operating after 10 p.m. or carrying standing passengers can also face fines as much as 10 years in jail. The changes went into effect mid-June. Meanwhile, minibus operators have increased fares, a move aimed to maintain what they were making when they were overloading their buses. Gold Mabuku is a minibus driver in Blantyre. He says we now sometimes quarrel with passengers trying to board with bags because we fear being jailed. So we are losing customers as many of them take us to be rude. The state-owned Malawi news agency reported Monday the Lilongwe Senior Magistrate Court fined 5 drivers $140 each for driving under the influence of alcohol. Police spokesman Kadadzera says police need more speed guns and breathalyzer machines to curb reckless driving.
In fact, all of these gadgets are there, but may not be everywhere. Yeah, we have insufficient numbers. They may not be always there.
He says police have increased traffic patrols to check vehicles and drivers. Bus operators say the government needs to do its part as well and improve the country's roads to ensure safety driving. Benson Chiwaka is an operations manager for AXA Bus Company in Malawi.
They're not wide enough. They're getting smaller and smaller when they're eaten up by the rains. So the roads they need to be worked on as well.
Malawi President Peter Mutharika has set up a joint committee with the Ministries of Labour and Transport to explore further ways to stop the road carnage. Lamek Masina for VOA News. Lamek Masina for VOA News. Blantyre, Malawi.
The Nigerian military says as many as 700 Boko Haram militants surrendered this week near the Sambisa forest in the country's Borno state. Army spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Usma says the large-scale surrender is proof that the war against Boko Haram is yielding major dividend. He says among those who surrender were senior members of the militant group.
Because of a series of bombardment on suspected Boko Haram terrorist hideouts, particularly in the area of responsibility of 26th Task Force Brigade, quite a number of them decided to throw in the towel and surrender. We have the information, over 700 of them wanted to surrender. But Monday morning, 70 of them came out from hiding, and efforts are on receiving other members. I cannot say precisely what is the figure now, but definitely the number is over 700. And one good thing about it is that part of those who have surrendered, there were some of those that are key commanders and influential people among them. And particularly there is a highly wanted Boko Haram terrorist suspect who is serial number 225 on the poster we issued out of over 200 suspected key Boko Haram terrorists. So far, they have been making beautiful statements, you know, that is helping the fight against terrorism and insurgency in the country.
Was there any information in terms of why these people are surrendering now, or is this an indication that your military operation is getting to them?
Just like I mentioned earlier on, because of the heavy artillery shelling and bombardment on some of the suspected locations that they realized that actually the game is up, they will no longer be hiding. But of course, due to information gotten from them, pointed out to the fact that actually there is massive, massive hunger and deprivation among them, and in fact there is issue of ethnicity and segregation among the fighters of remnants of the Boko Haram terrorists that were remaining. And their greatest fear actually was the issue of uncertainty. And that is why we are taking advantage of this to appeal to those remnants hiding that they should please come out. They have nothing to fear because there is the operation, you know, sub-corridor on. So long as someone surrenders, he should not fear anything, and they will be treated humanly, but definitely justice will take its own course.
Now, the Chief of Staff is congratulating the Nigerian Army and the Navy. Do you think it's too early to celebrate?
We have to congratulate ourselves because we have brought an unprecedented feat by defeating the terrorist group, which has never been done elsewhere before. You know, militarily, we have defeated the Boko Haram terrorists, so that is need to at least well done, even though we are yet to eliminate the terrorists as it were, and concerted efforts are on to do that. And it's a mark of encouragement with the selflessness and the dedication of our troops.
Is it true that some of these people are not just ordinary members of Boko Haram, but that some of those surrendering included some commanders or what you call influential members of the Boko Haram insurgency?
Exactly. Just because the investigation is ongoing, I don't want to divulge their names yet.
Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Usma is the Nigerian Army spokesman. He was speaking with me from Army headquarters in the capital, Abuja. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Button in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we will examine the contributions politicians of African descent are making and changing toward the political realities in the United States. We'll also discuss the new faces arriving on the political landscape on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.